Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it's my privilege and pleasure once again to present Martin A. Lee, the author of the vitally important recent book, The Beast Reawakens, published in hardcover by Little Brown. Martin, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you.
I'd like to explore in the next half hour some of the complexities of some of the relationship between so-called Nazi elements or Nazi elements that are viewed as peripheral or fringe and the mainstream, in particular in the wake of not only the Oklahoma City bombing, but also the surfacing of the militia movement and Patriots movement into the public eye. There has been, to my mind anyway, a disturbing polarization of the political analysis into either the government on one side or the militias or the Patriots networks on the one side. This is a more complex and less simple relationship than it has, in my opinion, been made out to be. An individual not directly connected to Oklahoma, not connected to Oklahoma City or directly, at least, to the militia and Patriot networks that I'm aware of, but whose career, I think, exemplifies the complexities in this situation, is Roy Frankhauser, and you write about him at some length.
Yes, I mean, Frankhauser's pretty old at this point. He's not directly involved. Actually, he's in jail, as last I heard. But he was active in the early 60s. In the 1970s, he was a government underground informant working for the FBI, the ATF, and other U.S. intelligence agencies, actually including Nixon's National Security Council, believe it or not.
Could you tell us about that last incident?
He was actually, apparently, it's a little bit murky. It was reported on CBS News back around 1972. Roy Frankau was asked to gather information on Arab extremist groups who were apparently based and operating in Canada, and he was used to gather information on this scene for the U.S. intelligence community during the Nixon years. Frankhauser himself was at one time or another involved in about 30 different far-right to neo-Nazi groups, different Klan chapters, the American Nazi Party, so forth and so on. And then he was exposed as being an FBI informant, and one would think that once that happens, your political career is ruined. How could you look at your erstwhile Nazi friends in the face again once you've been exposed as a fink for the FBI? But when I interviewed Robert Miles, who was sort of an ideologue, a philosopher, father figure for the Aryan Nations, back in the mid-80s, I spoke to him, and I asked him about Frankhauser, and he kind of just laughed and chuckled and said, "Well, Roy, he was spying on, the government thought he was spying on us, but we've always considered him one of us. As far as we were concerned, he was spying on the government for us, you know." So it's really hard to figure exactly what's going on here. There was recently the trial in Oklahoma where Robert Mylar, the head of Elohim City white supremacist encampment, in Oklahoma, which figures perhaps directly, perhaps peripherally, in the tale of Timothy McVeigh. Robert Mylar was identified by an FBI agent during a trial this past summer as being an FBI informant.
Mm-hmm.
The court went, "Oh my God, how could it be him?" And the problem here is, how you interpret something like that, Dave, because for starters, first thing that comes to my mind is, well, is this the FBI trying to screw up this scene at Elohim City and discredit this guy Mylar and make things difficult for him so they're saying he's an FBI agent? Maybe he never really was. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that, yeah, he did sometimes speak to the FBI and told them things, but his true loyalty always lay with his armed white supremacist colleagues at Elohim City. And that, in fact, it almost didn't matter that he was sometimes speaking to the FBI in terms of, where he was really coming from. But it's hard to know. It's not a question of either or. Either he's working for the government via the FBI or he's this neo-Nazi head. He could be both.
This is precisely the complexity that I had in mind. Speaking of, is it pronounced Mylar, by the way, or Mylar?
Robert Mylar, as far as I understand.
Alrighty, because I've been pronouncing it Mylar. Anyway, Mylar, his situation vis-a-vis his alleged status as an informant also calls to mind the complexities surrounding one of his boarders, I guess probably not the right term, but Andreas Strassmeier, who is definitely connected to McVeigh, whether or not he was involved with the bombing. We've touched on him before.
Yes, I mean, again, this is a very tricky area as well, because Andreas Strassmeier, this German neo-Nazi who is in charge of security and paramilitary training at Elohim City, and he gets that phone call from McVeigh, or apparently does, 2 weeks before the bombing, of Oklahoma City, federal building, McVeigh calls Elohim City. That we know for sure. But and we also know that Mylar and other leaders at Elohim City claim that he asked to speak to Strassmeyer, and that Strassmeyer denies ever talking to him. Maybe he did, in fact, ask to speak to Strassmeyer. McVeigh and Strassmeyer definitely were connected. They met each other 18 months before the bombing at a gun show in Tulsa. That's known. Both men acknowledge this. But Strassmeyer says that's the last he ever heard from McVeigh. Others claim that was really just the beginning of a very intense, important relationship. But, you know, the tricky thing here is that in the far right and neo-Nazi circles are now pointing the finger at Strassmeyer and claiming he was an agent of the U.S. government who was instigating McVeigh and encouraging him to undertake the bombing. Therefore, the government's behind the Oklahoma City bombing. That's what neo-Nazis want us to believe. And when we explore this whole area, which is very complex, and which we have to sort of, you know, allow some area that just acknowledge we don't know everything yet.
And which, excuse me for interrupting, Martin, in my opinion, this very issue that we're touching on has been oversimplified by both sides.
Well, when we discuss and explore this issue, we have to keep one thing in the mind in the very beginning. Neo-Nazis want us to believe that the U.S. government was behind the bombing.
Right.
The U.S. government had advanced warning of the bombing, and that allowed it to take place because either they sort of bungled the information and didn't act on it, or more sinisterly, that they simply wanted to see the building bombed for in order to crack down on the militia movement or institute a very harsh anti-terrorism bill, so forth and so on. That's the logic of the Nazis. So as we approach this area, we have to keep in mind that we need to be very, very careful and not get sort of sucked into assuming the worst about the U.S. government in every, you know, when looking at every piece of evidence. On the one hand. On the other hand, I mean, there are some very strange things that have happened, and the government doesn't seem to be coming clean here. Certainly the whole question about John Doe, too,
mm-hmm.
and whatever happened to him. The government says he's now, was never really a factor, it didn't really exist, so forth and so on. That strikes me as highly unlikely.
What's the name of the Philadelphia area white supremacist who many have cited as John Doe number two, the fellow from the Aryan Republican
Michael
Army?
Michael Brescia,
right.
Yes. And he was training. He was one of four Aryan Republican Army members who were training at Elohim City under Strassmeyer's tutelage. And, you know, a couple of people, or more than a few people, actually, more than a couple of, and in several cases now, Michael Brescia has been identified as looking like John Doe number two, as being John Doe number two. But others have said Strassmeyer was not John Doe number two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we don't know for sure, but this is certainly an area that's got to be explored and taken seriously, if only simply to ventilate it and say, you know, to run down all the leads and say, well, yeah, Strassmeyer was involved with these Republican Army bank robber terrorist types, and that's what happened. There's really no connection between these people and McVeigh. That's also possible. But at this point, we don't really know. We have to be very, very careful, because always keeping in mind that the Nazis want us to think that the government was behind it. And this is something we need to be, you know, cautious as we approach.
One of the people you talk about in your discussion of Oklahoma City, Strassmeyer, McVeigh, etc., and that is Carol Howe.
Yes, a lot revolves on the story of Carol Howe, this young woman, a debutante from Tulsa, who was sucked into the white supremacist scene, and she ended up getting roughed up sexually, to put it politely, by either one or more of the people who were hanging out at Elohim City, and then she turned around and became an informant for the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms Unit of the Treasury Department. And, I mean, in a nutshell, as far as we can make out, what happened is, for several months, Carol Howe is informing to her ATF superior, telling them that she's picking up on threats that people are making at Elohim City. People were talking about bombing buildings, taking direct action against the government, so forth and so on. And she's dutifully reporting this to her ATF handler. And then a few months before the Oklahoma City bombing, she's dropped as an informant. They decide that either she's unreliable or whatever, the information is not useful, and then she's let go. And then the bombing happens. 2 days later, she's hauled in to the ATF headquarters in Oklahoma, and she's debriefed. And she says, again, reiterates what she'd heard, that there were people like Dennis Mahan, former Ku Klux Klan leader in Tulsa, now associated with the group the White Aryan Resistance, that Dennis Mahan was making these threats, that Strassweyer was making threats and that others were. And when shown a picture of John Doe II, Carol Howe said it was Michael Brescia, this Aryan Republican Army guy who was hanging out at Elohim City with all these people. So, you know, again, how do you interpret this? I don't think that given the basis of, you know, what, or given the evidence that we know, that we're yet justified in jumping to the conclusion that, yes, this means exactly what the Nazis say, that the government knew ahead of time and let it go forward, or because, you know, they had their evil designs on anti-terrorism legislation and so forth. I would suggest the following, and again, we have to have a nuanced discussion here and look at all different sides of this. I don't think that a day has gone by since Elohim City existed when people haven't made threats against the government. I think this is what they live and breathe, this kind of hatred, this kind of scapegoating, and the idea of blowing up innocent people working in a federal building would be par for the course for people who are living in Elohim City. Whether or not what Carol Howe heard, and remember, all these macho gun nuts there are trying to impress her, they're trying to get her in bed with them. She is sleeping with more than one of them. I mean, it's a strange situation. In fact, some of the people she's now blaming as part of this plot were the very people that she claims raped her. And you have to wonder, is there a revenge motive going on here? You know,
She did pass a polygraph examination.
Yes, she did. Well, again, but what exactly, that, what parts of her testimony she that would tend to verify, you know, still a little bit unclear. That evidence was introduced into a court trial when she herself was brought to trial by the U.S. government this past summer, because the government now was claiming that she had been making threats against individuals and federal government targets, and had on her property, on her premises, bomb-making equipment and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And her attorney argued successfully that indeed all this equipment was there because she was working undercover for the U.S. government. It was her job to collect this evidence against these other people. So it seems that there's you know, some kind of retributive action that the U.S. government was taking against Carol Howe. Either they wanted to shut her up, put her in her place. Who knows exactly, you know, what's going on here? But this is a very, very intriguing story, and it may well, we may well see that the trial of Terry Nichols ended up shedding more light on all of this than the McVeigh trial did, which really didn't shed any light on this at all.
There are a number of complexities to the situation. It's one of the reasons why I expressed my dissatisfaction with the political rhetoric to date. Do you think that some of Andrea Strassmeyer's connections in Europe might have perhaps produced what, for lack of a better term, might be called a diplomatic cover-up in this country?
Yes, I think that's very, very possible. See, when people are on the far right in the U.S. are pointing the fingers at Strassmeyer now, we see it in the Spotlight magazine saying, here, Strassmeyer is the government agent, and the U.S. government knew, and he was working for the U.S. government, and how else would he have gotten this favored treatment while he was in the United States? How could he have stayed in the U.S. without the right immigration credentials, the work, you know, work papers and so forth? How is it that he was stopped by a state trooper in Oklahoma, and that when they pulled him over and they found some strange papers in his car and other things, why wasn't he nailed when it showed that he didn't have the right credentials and papers? Why wasn't he thrown in jail? And the ultra-right has seized upon this as signs that, see, this is proof that Strassmeyer was favored by the U.S. government because he was working for them. And a much more plausible interpretation is that Strassmeyer, given the fact that he had these high-powered family connections back in Germany, his father was a high-ranking official of the Christian Democratic Union, very close to Helmut Kohl, his de facto chief of staff at one point. That's how he got this favored treatment, because his father pulled diplomatic strings for him.
According to Germany Alert, his attendance at the reunification ceremony would have mandated a security clearance from the German government.
Who is attendance?
Strassmeyer's.
Andreas's or his father's?
I believe Andreas's.
I don't remember that from Germany Alert per se, because I know his father was in Germany when Germany was... his father was in Berlin when Germany was reunified, when the wall came down. That was the de facto beginning of reunification.
Right.
His father was celebrating the streets with Helmut Kohl. I can't say what Andreas Strassmeyer
I believe he was actually present. I'd have to double-check, but I believe, according to German Alert, he was actually present at the ceremony.
We will have to check that, but I think that's unlikely. I think we may be confusing Andreas, the son, with Günther, the father.
Could be.
Günther Strassmeyer, I know for sure, was in Berlin. I think he's the head of the Christian Democratic Union in Berlin. But the point is here, you know, you have these situations where the federal officials in the United States and police officials who rub shoulders with Strassmeyer and cross his path appear to be giving him favorable treatment. And in my opinion, that's because he has these high-powered Democrats. It's like if Chelsea Clinton got into some kind of trouble in Germany, you know. You think her parents wouldn't intervene and pull her out of that situation or whatever? Of course. You know, this is just the way the world works. It doesn't justify leaping to the conclusion that he's an agent of the U.S. government. Really, he's got a powerful, wealthy father in Germany. That's what's going on.
Well, plus, he wasn't exactly at a recreational facility at Elohim City, so that would prove embarrassing as well.
Sure, of course it would. And we shouldn't conclude either that he shares his father's politics, that his father is some kind of neo-Nazi, because he was. I mean,
I don't think we should conclude the opposite either, that his father is totally dissociated.
His father was, as far as I know, one of the leaders of a highly nationalistic faction within the Christian Democratic Union.
Right.
That was always agitating for German reunification, even at a time when politicians can only give lip service to it because it seemed like such a remote and distant possibility. And things changed very dramatically in 1989. But his father was always one of these, I wouldn't want to say ultra-nationalist, maybe even extreme nationalist is too strong a word, but he was certainly a very strong nationalist agitating in this direction. It's perfectly plausible that his son was in part rebelling against his father, and his politics was more extreme, just as Carol Howe, the ATF informant that we referred to earlier in the conversation, Devin, her father was a Fortune 500 CEO, and she was like a rebellious teenager. You know, where does she drift toward? White trash. You know, I mean, these kind of dynamics don't mean that, you know, she's an agent of the Fortune 500 at Elohim City. It means,
sure.
There are plenty of nuances and reasons that can give a less sinister interpretation of events that are possible.
One of the relationships that I think also highlights the complexities of some of the things we're discussing, and that is the relationship between Andrea Strassmeyer and a white supremacist attorney who has become something of a fixture in American fascism, namely Kirk Lyons.
Well, Kirk Lyons is a very, very important figure within the white supremacist scene in the United States.
And also, if you could mention the relationship between Lyons and also Dennis Mahone, who's visited Germany, and a guy named Bernd Schmittbauer.
Yes, I mean, it's, in a nutshell, I mean, Kirk Lyons, he's an attorney. He's very closely associated with the hardest of the hardcore in the United States, the Aryan Nations. When he got married in 1990, it was actually a double wedding. Him and his law partner got married to two sisters, the Tate sisters, whose brother had actually been a member of the Order and was in jail for, this neo-Nazi group that was going around robbing banks and actually killing people. They killed a talk show host in Denver.
Right.
It's a famous incident. This is back in the early, mid-1980s now. And the best man for Kirk Lyons, when he got married at Aryan Nations encampment in Idaho in the summer of 1990, was Louis Beam, the premier military strategist for the U.S. Nazi underground.
Didn't Lyons also defend Beam at an earlier trial with regard to Oklahoma City?
When Beam and a few other leaders of the neo-Nazi scene spinning out of the Aryan Nations and the Order were arrested and actually put to trial and charged with sedition, they went to trial in 1987-88. Lyons represented Louis Beam, who had formerly been the Ku Klux Klan leader in Texas and is now really the Aryan Nation ambassador at large, perhaps the key person, you know, associated with the Aryan Nations right now. And what's interesting is that Lyons pops up whenever there's a Ku Klux Klan person of note within that scene to be defended, or a Holocaust denier or something like that. It seems that Lyons is always at his side defending him. And he was Strassmeyer's attorney, or is Strassmeyer's attorney. He helped Andreas Strassmeyer come to the United States. I interviewed Kirk Lyons several times while I was researching The Beast Reawakens. And it was very clear that he played a pivotal role in bringing Andreas Strassmeyer over to the United States and introducing him to the people at Elohim City, opening that door which he walked through, which enabled Strassmeyer to become the security chief and the paramilitary trainer there.
Something that I think we could probably assume would be embarrassing to both the German and U.S. governments.
Yes, it would be. The fact of the matter is, Kirk Lyon, who's close, he's not just an attorney for these neo-Nazis and these militia types. He's a legal advisor to many militia groups today. He's also one of them. He strongly identifies with their ideology and their politics. He's not coy about this. And at one point, Kirk Lyons went and visited the Strassmeyer's residence in Berlin, and he met with Mr. and Mrs. Strassmeyer, mom and dad of Andreas, his mm-hmm. client, just to tell him that Andreas is doing fine in Oklahoma and no problems, he's happy, and, you know, the kind of thing that if you happen to be in Germany and, you know, you would, and you were representing somebody, you might do. And the fact that Kirk Lyons, a key player in the neo-Nazi scene, is sitting in the living room of Günter Strassmeyer, one of the leaders of the Christian Democratic Union, to me is embarrassing enough. But, you know, again, in looking at the situation now, what I detect is sort of a war going on within the extreme right, where the Liberty Lobby and the Spotlight are now claiming that Strassmeyer and Lyons were somehow mixed up with the U.S. government.
Oh, is Lyons now being tarred by the Spotlight as a government agent, too?
Yes, and it's clear that there's a long-running feud between them. I mean, it's kind of ironic, because in the same issue, you'll find Louis Beam writing in the Spotlight. The issue before, the Spotlight's teeing off against Andreas Strassmeyer and his lawyer, Kirk Lyons.
At whose wedding he was the best man.
Yeah, and it's not, obviously it's not Beam who's doing it, but it just shows some of the internecine maneuvering and fighting going on within the neo-Nazi circles right now. It is, to me, virtually impossible, the notion that Kirk Lyons is an FBI guy. He is a neo-Nazi, true and true, you know. Whether he and his part of his law practice has ever had to speak to the FBI, I'm sorry, that's plausible. But to identify him as first and foremost an agent of the U.S. government is really perverse and very misleading, and that's what the Spotlight is trying to do, and it's all part of this effort to say this whole bomb, that whole bombing plot that happened was really a U.S. federal government plot, and, you know, it's something we have to be very, very careful about.
Somebody who has networked with both Kirk Lyons and Dennis Mahone, or Mahon, whose name has also been kicked around in connection with Oklahoma City, and someone whose relationship with him once again illustrates the complexities of some of these things. That's a fellow named Bernd Schmidbauer.
Yeah, Bernd Schmidbauer. Bernd Schmidbauer was, or at least he appeared to be an important player within the neo-Nazi scene in Germany. He ran a martial arts studio that provided security, or people who were trained at a security, at a martial arts studio, were serving as sort of security personnel for visiting dignitaries when they came to Germany and did the rounds and spoke to neo-Nazi groups all around the country. And it was Schmidt who was providing the security for, including Kirk Lyons, when he came and visited visited Germany as part of a speaking tour with him and Fred Lichter, a Holocaust denier that was a client of Lyons. They were going and they were speaking in Germany ostensibly to try to raise money for Lichter's legal defense, because he was being charged with crimes in Germany on the basis of having denied the Holocaust in public speeches. That's technically against the law, even though people do it a lot of times in Germany. This time, these people were nailed. So Lyons came back and then tried to raise additional money for Lichter. And Schmidt, Bernd Schmidt, was providing security. It turned out that Schmidt was also working for West German intelligence. And again, it's one of those questions, where did his loyalty really lie? The fact that he had this double game that he was playing does not necessarily mean the people that he provided security for were in some ways tainted by some connection to the West German or U.S. Secret Services. They didn't know this guy was playing a double game. But again, it shows you that it's a very murky world that's open, you know, and this information is open to multiple interpretation as to what's really going on.
One of the things that has tended to evolve in connection with the militia and patriots movements and networks, and that is the notion that somehow they are extremists and apart from the right wing as a whole in the United States. And in fact, there's an element of continuity between some elements of the Republican Party and some of its leading political lights and some elements of this same milieu.
I see it as a continuum. And on one, the far end of the continuum is the hardest of the hardcore, the groups like the Aryan Nations and so forth. And then you sort of slide toward the under end of the continuum and the sort of the more moderate end of the extreme right, if you will. And there you have people like Pat Robertson and the Christian Coalition that aren't overtly white supremacist or racialist, but yet whose political machinations and networks overlap at certain times and at certain points with white supremacist elements.
You mentioned that Pat Robertson's writings smack of things like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Well, again, not in the international Jewish conspiracy type of way or the Zog conspiracy. the conspiracy that, or the huge centuries-old humongous conspiracy that Pat Robertson depicts in his best-selling book, The New World Order. It was best-seller in 1994. That's a conspiracy that, at the heart of it, as he puts it, is European bankers. They just happen to have Jewish names, these bankers, but he doesn't peg it as a Jewish conspiracy. And he attributes to this overarching centuries-old conspiracy of several, what he considers very unfortunate events in history, the French Revolution, assassination of Lincoln, beginning of World War I and World War II. He attributes to this sinister cabal that stretches back centuries. It's a kind of conspiratorial view of history that obviously has to be rejected because it's crazy. And it's very different, I think, from efforts on the part of responsible historians and others to analyze events that are unfolding in our recent times and sketch out relationships between different factions and elements within ruling circles and the power circles in the United States, and point out the collusion, the collaboration, and so forth, what otherwise you might say is conspiracies. That's not necessarily the same as this, trying to depict this monster conspiracy going way back to the building of the Egyptian pyramids or something.
It's interesting to see him target Pat Robertson, that is, targeting the French Revolution, which was a frequent rhetorical target of fascist leaders in the world, pre-World War II and World War II periods, and also the aforementioned Klaus Naumann, also targeted the same event.
Well, again, it's a conservative or deeply conservative impulse, or I should say reactionary right-wing impulse, to reject the French Revolution because that's where democracy as a form of government comes from. That's its origins, in a sense. And I think it's a deeply anti-democratic sentiment that's reflected in the writings of Pat Robertson and in others at different points in history that have looked upon the French Revolution as this calamitous event that from which we have to sort of, if we can somehow get back there and then not make the same mistake and then go forward, that's sort of what they want.
The last minute plus here, there are elements of continuity between some of the ideological foundations of the patriots and militia movements and some elements of the so-called respectable right. Thinking now about the anti-abortion elements associated with institutions like Human Life International and about things like the Wise Youth Movement. We've only got about a minute.
Well, again, it is a continuum. Various different factions and groups overlap. The militia movement as a whole, various tributaries feed into it. But I would want to strongly emphasize that not everybody who joins a militia movement or militia group is a white supremacist or a neo-Nazi. The white supremacist component of the militias, while very influential, represent a numerical minority within that movement, which in some ways makes it all the more dangerous, but it's something we can explore at another time.
Right. As I said, I think the rhetoric in the wake of Oklahoma City has tended to be oversimplified on all sides with regard to these issues. We've been speaking with Martin Lee, the author of the vitally important recent book, The Beast Reawakens, published in hardcover by Little Brown. Martin, thanks for appearing with us, and we'll rejoin these issues at a future date.
Thank you, David.